Welcome to the psych ward. I'm Mandy, aka Nurse Cyanide, and with me is Dr. Darian.
Hello.
Each episode, we'll be checking in a new horror villain, giving their psychological ailments, and basically discussing them in general. So this episode, we have Patrick Bateman checking into the psych ward.
I live in the American Gardens building on West 81st Street, on the 11th floor. My name is Patrick Bateman. I'm 27 years old. I believe in taking care of myself, in a balanced diet, and a rigorous exercise routine. In the morning, if my face is a little puffy, I'll put on an ice pack while doing my stomach crunches. I can do 1,000 now.
He suffers from narcissism, psychopathic behavior, and hedonistic thrill killing. His history includes the movie American Psycho, as well as the book. So, Dr. Darian, what are your thoughts on Patrick Bateman?
I've got a lot of thoughts on this guy. I watched the movie again last night. I did not read the book. I understand you read the book, Mandy?
I've read it a few times. It's funny because I read it years ago on traveling on a Greyhound bus. So I'm sure everyone else thought I was kind of nuts for that.
I would assume so, yeah. And from what I understand, weird things happen on Canadian Greyhound buses. But that's a topic for a whole other show right there.
Yeah.
Speaking of America, there should be a Canadian Psycho book written some point. I agree with everything you said. Narcissistic behavior. So textbook sociopath, I think. We can agree on that just from the get-go. Just listening to his monologues as he looks in the mirror and describes his day and his psychological stance and where he's, you know, just mentally where he's at. But something I think we don't really consider when we deal with this character is really, I think he's more of a product of his times. And by that I mean that the 80s, which is when the story takes place, the 80s excess, the cutthroat rise up the corporate ladder. And I feel like he is the personification of all of that, the embodiment of that entire, not necessarily the decade. Well, I guess, the decade in its own sense. But like from 85 to 80. To about 92-ish, when things were like at their sleaziest. You know what I mean, Mandy?
Oh, yeah.
Like you had the sleazy businessmen and the corporate environments where sexual harassment was just an everyday thing. And, you know, you had to distinguish yourself not so much by the job that you did, but sometimes just by your haircut or the suit that you wore or the weirdo sexual energy around your business card. How creepy is that whole sequence?
Well, and that's really what in the movie, at least, and I think in the book too, sparks like the first murder, because they have the whole weird business card scene and they're all white, but I guess just different shades of white and the font's a little bit different,
right?
And so Patrick Bateman just gets like super jealous over one of the other guys' business cards that all look the same, but his is a little bit better. And he can't have that this rival has, you know, the better business card. So that's what leads him to killing Paul Allen.
Which is so strange.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, we'll get to the end in a minute. But throughout the movie, we actually don't see that many kills. There's the homeless guy.
Yeah.
And then after that, things are alluded to. Evidence is kind of around, but it's not really shown, and then the end is ambiguous enough to where you're going, oh god, did any of this really happen?
Yeah, exactly. I think for me, well, the two murders that I liked the best.
You're crazy. You're sick. You're a sicko. You're a sick lady.
The Paul Allen one, I think that whole scene is just amazing, where he's got like all the newsprint on his floor in his apartment, and he's like throws on like the clear raincoat and he's explaining Huey Lewis and Hip to Be Square and just going into like the whole history and like the what the song means and all that, and then he just basically like clocks him in the head with an axe and straight up murders him. And it's just really strange, but it almost feels like it's got the essence of the 80s, because you have the 80s music and then like the excess of like, you know, repeatedly smacking him in the head with an axe.
Absolutely. All that on top of the ultra-hygienic fashion in which he has set up his apartment, covered his clothing, and has gotten Paul Allen drunk enough to a point to where he doesn't really... There's not going to be any resistance. And even if he were to somehow escape, Paul is completely... You know, he thinks that Patrick Bateman is somebody else.
Yeah, that's the whole part they all do.
Yeah, they all... Nobody, and it's almost... You know, ironic in a way, because the whole time Patrick in his monologues is stating that I am an idea of Patrick Bateman, but I am simply not here, which is coincidental because nobody knows. I mean, like his core group of friends, they refer to him as Patrick Bateman, but is he really Patrick Bateman? Is the character Patrick Bateman really who he is, or is he the other guy that everybody thinks he is? His attorney refers to him as Davis. Paul Allen refers to him as, what was it, like Vander something?
Yeah.
So we really don't even know who the hell this guy is, if this is actually Patrick Bateman at all.
Yeah, exactly.
But that kind of fits into the 80s motif of conformity, hip to be square, you know, just wanting to fit in a way, not expressing any individuality, which is so strange to me. Now... Mandy, I know you're a lot younger than I am, but what year were you born?
I'm not a lot younger. I was born in 81.
You're a lot younger than me, Mandy. God damn it. So you probably remember the 80s, right?
Yep, I remember the 80s.
So what do you think? We were obviously too young to be part of the corporate cutthroat environment or the sleazy business operations, but you probably remember a lot of the clothing and the music and the pop culture of the era.
Fluorescent clothes and big crimped hair. I still have my original crimper from the 80s.
Wow. you ever tease up the hair just for nostalgia's sake?
I did it when I recorded an episode on 80s music like a year ago. I crimped it up.
I love it. I know you love posting selfies, Mandy. I want to see one with the crimped hair at some point.
Yes, for sure. I'll do it full 80s one. Big ass crimped hair.
I will not, because I don't know. I'm not going to do that. I don't think I have any 80s style clothing, so I don't feel the... I could put a suit and tie on, if that would help.
Yeah, see, that's kind of all. I mean, that's kind of like classic too, right? It fits every decade.
Exactly. And I do it for the YouTube show anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But what do you feel like this movie fit the 80s in its own way?
I think that it fits like the whole, like... the classic yuppie Wall Street persona of the 80s that like a lot of those like other movies and stuff had at the time with those like the banker shirts or whatever I think they're called, where it's like the white and blue striped shirts, and then they have like the suspenders on and it's that whole total yuppie culture of it. And like every time in the movie when they're going out to dinner at like the weird fancy restaurants and everything, like that really fits with all that part of the 80s. I think
I agree completely. Now the underlying factor of this entire movie is that Patrick Bateman is a sociopath. We understand that. He's a killer. Possibly a killer, depending on your interpretation.
See, there's lots of scenes, though, because, like, the one where he chases the one hooker with a chainsaw.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just... that's a great scene, too, where she's, like, trying to get out of the apartment and just finds, like, all the corpses everywhere. And he's, like, naked except for running shoes.
Right.
And he's covered in blood and just chasing after her with a chainsaw. And so she runs down the stairs and he's kind of, like, lining it up and then drops the chainsaw down the stairs. Which is funny because I just realized that's a parallel with Christian Bale playing Batman in Dark Knight Rises, I want to say. Where it's, like, the opening with the, it is Dark Knight Rises, with the parking garage. And the one guy's, like, driving down the spiral, like, exit ramp of the parking garage. And he's standing there as Batman, like, watching him go around to line up to jump on the roof of the van.
I didn't think of that. That's a good point. Yeah. I like it. Yeah, that's a good point. So you're saying you're pretty sure that all of the murders actually did happen. Yeah?
I think that, see, it's hard because they show them.
Right.
They show them happening, but it's also, like, is it, a hallucination of him?
That's what I think. I don't think any of it actually happened. And the reason why is because of the very last scene.
Yeah, that whole starts where it starts at the ATM even too.
Yeah, and not when he confronts the attorney, but when he goes back to Paul Allen's apartment and everything is scrubbed, and there's a real estate agent showing people around, and he's like, There was dead bodies in this closet
yeah.
12 hours ago. What the hell happened? And she's like, I think you should probably just leave. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to leave. I'm never going to come back. I think really it was all just kind of his twisted little fantasy.
But see, with that, too, it could just be like, because it's like 80s greed and everything, like maybe she just really wanted to sell the apartment, so she just got rid of all the bodies.
That's
why she's like, you should leave.
Absolutely. That's a very real possibility. That may be the sleaziest real estate agent ever. But, yeah. You know, 1980s New York, what do you expect?
Yeah, but yeah, that's so weird, because like even when he leaves the message for his attorney and then goes to see him later and he's like, what are you talking about? I had lunch with Paul Allen a few days ago. And he's like, what?
Yeah. But see again, now his attorney is referring to him by a completely different name.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So here is this need to conform and to fit in and to sacrifice your individuality. But it's like to the point where nobody even recognizes you or knows who you are anymore.
Yeah, it's I think that's like probably like another, you know, product of the 80s too, because it's like I said, no one recognizes him. Everyone calls him different names. He gets people confused, and it's just because they're all so like cutthroat and just want to climb the corporate ladder. They don't even like correct other people when they're calling them wrong names. They're just like, yep, and then go along with it because it's, you know, to keep like the status quo of everything.
Yeah. Totally. I like it. There is one scene I wanted to ask you about and get your thoughts on. The point where he brings his secretary, Jean, over to his apartment.
Yeah.
I think I sent you a meme of this about 2 o'clock in the morning this morning.
But love those ones where it's like that with the horror movie quotes against, or the horror movie scenes against the other quotes.
Yeah, against the cutesy falling in love.
Yeah. Yeah.
So here we have a brief glimpse of humanity out of Patrick Bateman. He has he has every intention of murdering Jean, played by Chloe Sevigny, or Sevigny, depending on how you want to pronounce it. And at the last minute, he decides not to. So do you think that he, in his own weird way, had feelings for Jean? Or just
there's a whole monologue where, like, he talks... There's a lot of monologues.
There is.
He talks about how, like... She's the type of girl or whatever that, like, you know, follows him around, and someone that he'd probably end up marrying one day, and how she's the only one that's basically, like, good, sort of, like, good and pure. And that scene where he is about to kill her is, like, when his fiance calls and leaves a message that kind of, like, sort of snaps him out of, you know, whatever, like, murderous zone he's in, I guess. And he's like, and kind of, you know, like, lets her go. So I think that, you know, I don't know if it's because that snapped him out of it or if he really just does think that she's, like, you know, a good, pure soul and basically lets her go because of that. But she does find his book of all, like, his weird, like, murder drawings and stuff at the end, too.
Which was a lot of fun. Yeah. I wish I had time to put together a book of murder drawings. Yeah. I'm not much of an artist, though, so it'd be mostly stick figures with boobs.
Well, they also didn't have, like, social media back then. So.
That's true. I don't think I would post my murder drawings.
Yeah.
I'd probably keep keep it like, I don't want my kids seeing it either, because I get probably pretty pornographic. But that's a whole other show right there.
Well, that's also probably like why he had time. So
that's true. And to be honest, he never really did his job. I don't know if there was even a job to do. Because he would go to his office and do crossword puzzles and listen to his Walkman. But we never really saw him doing any kind of work of any kind, did we?
No. Sit-ups.
Sit-ups, yeah. Crunches. What do you think, Mandy? Was Patrick Bateman pretty hot?
I like Christian Bale.
Yeah?
But it's funny. I liked him since he was, like, in stuff as, like, a kid in Newsies, which is, like, super old.
Of course.
But it's funny when he speaks with an American accent because you can hear his lisp a lot more.
Yeah.
Because when he has, like, when he has his regular Welsh accent, you can hear his lisp a lot. But when it's an American one, especially, like, as Batman, you can, like, see it in his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could see it like a lot in this movie, but
yeah, he does have a weird mouth thing going
yeah.
on. Like he doesn't move his.
He tries
upper
to hide his lisp when he speaks with an American accent, but it comes out a lot more.
Yeah, it's not so bad in this one, but I think that term it really came out in that Terminator movie.
Yeah,
what was that? Salvation, I think.
Salvation and in. The Dragon movie where he has his normal Welsh accent.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, that was a terrible movie.
Yeah. Matthew McConaughey.
Yes, Reign of Fire, that one.
Yes.
Gerard Butler as his little sidekick.
Yeah.
Good fucking dragons is what it is. That's a whole other episode. We'll have to do a psych evaluation on dragons one of these days.
Yeah, dragons in general.
And the people who chase them in tanks.
Yeah. I think with this movie, one of the things that makes it stand out a bit more to people, too, is the whole juxtaposition of, like, the upbeat 80s music with, like, the horrific killing scenes.
Totally.
Because we talked about the Huey Lewis one, and there's one where it's, like, he doesn't kill them, but it's, like, the first scene with the two hookers, and he's going on about, like, Genesis and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's just basically having sex with them, and then you see him, like, pull out his, like, I don't know, murder kit or whatever, like, all the coat hangers and stuff.
Yeah. There's a hole puncher in there, too.
Yeah.
Did you catch that?
Yeah.
What are you going to do with a hole puncher?
I don't know. Pierce their ears with a hole puncher.
Oh, God, that sounds terrible.
In the book, there's, like, a lot more graphic.
I was just going to ask that, because I'm curious about what happened with the hookers after they woke up. But seeing the state they were in as they left his apartment, I don't know that I want to get that into it. Did the book go into that at all?
Yeah, it's a lot more graphic about what he does to them.
Well, they left there alive.
Everything that's implied. Yeah, but he just basically beats them a lot. I'm kind of surprised that he doesn't kill them there, which is strange.
Right.
You know, like, he thinks, like, later on he does kill the one, but yeah, it's weird.
Yeah.
And the book, too, there's more murders, because I'm pretty sure, yeah, in the book he ends up killing a child.
Oh, no.
And it's like, he does it just to see how he'd feel about doing it. And then he ends up thinking, like, he doesn't really like it because killing a child doesn't really have that much effect as, like, an adult would, because more people would be upset about an adult being killed because they've, I guess, been in more people's lives than a child. But they decided to leave that out of the movie, I guess, for obvious reasons.
I'm okay with that. I don't think we need that.
Yeah.
That's a little weird.
Yeah, exactly.
Mandy, did you see the sequel to this one?
I saw it, like, years ago. The thing is, it's... And I was reading about it again, too, this week in prepping for the episode. It's not really a sequel. They just kind of, like, once it was in production, they sort of, like, threw Patrick Bateman into it.
Yeah. Yeah, they do that a lot with horror films.
To just sort of, like, capitalize on, it's American Psycho 2, and there's this one scene with him, you know, and he's mentioned in it, like, a handful of times.
Yeah. Yeah, they do that a lot in horror movies. I think the Hellraiser franchise got the worst smattering of that. They'll make a completely independent movie, and then at the last minute they'll decide to put a franchise tag on it and find a way to shoehorn characters in.
He is mentioned in The Rules of Attraction, though, and Bret Easton Ellis did write that book as well.
Oh.
And his brother, Patrick Bateman's brother, Sean Bateman, is in Rules of Attraction. The movie is played by James Vanderbeek. And I guess they wanted to put a scene with Patrick Bateman in it, because I think there's, like, one scene in the book or something, but they ended up, like, cutting it from the movie because Christian Bale didn't want to be Patrick Bateman again. And then they wanted the author, Bret Easton Ellis, to be Patrick Bateman, but he didn't want to do it because he thought it'd be, like, a slap in the face to Christian Bale. So then I guess they had someone else do it, and then it ended up getting cut from the movie.
Yeah, that'd be a little weird. Now, I think I've seen that. Is that not the one where Shannon Sossamon gets raped and thrown up on?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah. I was trying to figure... I remember seeing that scene in a movie and being like, this is actually a pretty good movie. And it had Clifton Collins Jr. in it, who's like, I'm pretty gay for that guy. But I was like, what is this movie? I couldn't remember it, but now it's The Rules of Attraction?
Yeah, The Rules of Attraction.
I'm going to write that down.
One of my favorite parts is where it's like... The two gay guys in the hotel room
jumping on the bed,
their faith.
Acting hooligans.
Yeah,
big gay hooligans in a hotel room.
Every time now I hear the song Faith, I just think of that because it's hilarious.
Oh, absolutely.
But that's almost like a prequel. I mean, if you want to go in chronological order of things, mention it because his brother's in it. So that would be before American Psycho, I believe.
Okay, very cool.
There is an idea of a Patrick Bateman, some kind of abstraction, but there is no real me, only an entity, something illusory. And though I can hide my cold gaze, and you can shake my hand and feel flesh gripping yours, and maybe you can even sense our lifestyles are probably comparable, I simply am not.
So in the sequel to the movie, we basically pick up with Mila Kunis, who is the daughter of one of Patrick Bateman's victims. And she then is she basically turns into the next American Psycho. She has very similar monologues, except this one takes place in a college campus and is basically her trying to gain a spot as a teacher's aide for a very prominent FBI profiler slash college professor, played by William Shatner.
Yeah,
by the way, who did a great job. Movie itself, not that great. Not even really in the same vein as American Psycho. I think if we were to build an American Psycho franchise, we would have to go like decade by decade and almost do like an American Horror Story version where we're just picking up with different killers and showing how they personify the time that they live in.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much the meat and potatoes of American Psycho, is that we have this psycho, obviously, and he is really just a product of his times in the 1980s. So, like, if we were to do one for the 1990s, we would probably want somebody that was into, like, party hip-hop in a weird way. I don't know. He'd probably have, like, a pager on him, and he'd be complaining about the Clinton administration. I have no idea. I'll just keep talking, though. I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Well, there was a lot of, like, cocaine and stuff in American Psycho, so I don't know what it would be in the 90s, maybe Ecstasy? Or is that 2000s?
I have no idea.
Raves? Well, that'd be probably more like 2000s one, where he'd be, like, killing people at raves.
Yeah, he might be, like, a little bit on the goth side, a little bit. Mm. Maybe, like, listening to Montel. Well, no, that's not very goth. I don't know. I have no idea. It'd be weird. Because, I mean, the 90s really was just, like, the byproduct of the 80s. You know, you had the excess of the 80s. Then in the 90s, we started to dial it back. And then, he'd definitely be, like, he'd probably be, like, a grunge guy, right?
Yeah.
Like a flannel shirt. Yeah. Like, acting like he doesn't care about anything. He'd be kind of a prick, now that I talk about it.
Yes.
Be a bit of a doucher. But I say you can skip the sequel unless you're hot for Mia Kunis. She is pretty hot, and there is some weird sexual situations there. it did have there's an actor in the sequel. You may or may not remember him. There was a show that came on in the late 80s, early 90s about a vampire cop called Forever Night. Did you ever see that?
I think, like, it sounds very vaguely familiar to me.
The school counselor from American Psycho 2 played the vampire cop in Forever Night.
Okay.
So that's a little something for you there, Mandy.
A little tidbit of trivia.
Yeah, buddy. Did my homework. So, overall, how do you feel about America? Is this one of your favorites? Is this one of your favorite killers?
I like it. I've seen it quite a bit. There was an awkward time where, I don't know if, like, it was just on TV or something when I was over at, like, visiting my dad. Mm-hmm. And so that's, and, like, it came to, like, the sexy and stuff. I'm like, this is awkward.
Well, yeah.
I'm not really into watching this in the same room with my father.
Yeah, you don't want to watch that with your dad.
But I've seen it quite a bit. I've read the book on a bus trip.
Nice.
I like it. I mean, I think it's a pretty good movie. I like the juxtaposition of the music and stuff while he's explaining it, you know, the music while he's killing people. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's, like, you know, something different and kind of makes it stand out a lot to people, and why it's probably, like, hit pop culture so much more than maybe other movies. Oh. Just because of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I like it, and I like that it kind of has one of those open-ended endings, right, where it's like, did he really kill all these people, or is he just crazy and hallucinating that he did kill them, and you never really get that answer.
Right. Did the book end the same way, or did we get any kind of a solid
No, answer? it ends the same way, and he kind of just, in the book, he kind of goes on to explain it a bit more about how that, you know, he's kind of, like, super bummed out that the lawyer didn't believe him, and that his confession was all for nothing, really. And, you know, he really did want to be caught to kind of get some kind of relief for it. So he does think that, you know, he really killed everyone and wants that ending for himself.
Very cool. if we follow the film franchise, then we would have to say yes, he did kill all those people.
Yes.
Because it picks up with one of his victim's daughters. And he's kind of mentioned in the criminal psychology class also.
Yeah.
If I were to rewrite the ending to this, I think I would have him get killed in that police shootout towards the end.
And just leave it there.
Yeah. I mean, that's not really the ending that obviously the writer had in mind, because he wanted the open ending, did this really happen type of a thing. But I think the only way to end a story about 80s excess, a movie, I should say, about 80s excess and a serial killer placed therein, I think is to end it with an excessive kill at the end. So I would have him just get riddled by the cops.
Yeah, I can see that.
What do you think, Mandy? You think you like the ending the way it is, or would you rewrite that?
Well, I kind of can see both ways. Like, having him be shot by the cops and everything kind of fits with the whole, like, the excess, and, you know, you still leave it open-ended. But I also think that, like, the bit with, you know, him going to find his lawyer afterwards and his lawyer being like, no, I had lunch with Paul Allman, and you're this other guy, and you're confused, kind of fits with the whole rest of the story of, like, everyone confusing people for everybody else, and then you're like, well, maybe he, you know, he really didn't kill them, and is he this other guy, and is Paul Allen, you know, really still alive and having lunch with people? So I kind of like that ending for it.
Yeah, I agree. No, I'm not mad at the ending. Something I did want to touch on, though, is that there are certain, well, I guess there's really only one, but it felt like a lot more. There are some gay overtones to this.
Yeah, because he goes to kill the one guy in the bathroom.
Yeah, Lewis.
And then he ends up, like, sort of chickening out or whatever, and then that guy's like, oh, I'm, you know, I've been in love with you, and thinks that, like, you know, Bateman's hitting on him, and so he's like, confesses his love for him, and then Bateman's like all disgusted and leaves.
Well, I don't know if he's I mean, if there's anybody that you think he's going to kill, like, actually, like, really kill, like, had, like, is almost not, I don't want to say justified in killing, but, you know, yeah. that's for a psychopath, you would expect that reaction from that kind of a situation, that he's just naturally going to kill that guy. But instead, he gets all choked up. And when Matt Ross starts kissing his hands, he's like, whoa, what is this now? And then
I almost think that he was just more like kind of just turned off by the fact that someone was touching him.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think of that. I guess that would fit with the ultra sociopath kind of ultra
hygiene. Well, he's got, like, a weird, like, yeah, like, OCD thing about, like, you know, cleanliness and stuff, so.
Yeah, totally.
Makes the one hooker, like, have a bath and shit.
Yeah, that was so weird.
Yeah.
Well, that was the dirtier of the two hookers, so I guess that does make sense.
Yeah, he looked a little bit more homeless.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, because that was the one he picked up off the street, the other one is the Esther that he called.
Yeah, the high-end one. Very cool. I don't know about this Patrick Bateman character, Mandy.
I think that he's a classic psychopath.
I would agree, especially for being in the 80s.
Yeah, and the narcissism of the 80s, you know, the whole aesthetic of everything and just the corporate yuppie greed of it all, too, which really, you know, was driven by narcissism of all those people. So
right. Something else we haven't touched on is the bizarro love triangle. Like, I don't know if you call it a love triangle. More of a sex triangle that goes on in this movie. So you have our Patrick Bateman, who's engaged to Reese Witherspoon. However, he's pretty sure, although it's not ever overtly stated, that Reese is cheating on him with his friend Bryce.
Yeah.
Which is fine, because he's actually on the side nailing Courtney, who is engaged to the gay guy that started kissing Patrick's hands in the bathroom.
Yep.
So, I don't know how all this fits together, because, I mean, that's not really sociopathic behavior. It's more, I don't know if you call that even narcissistic behavior, because that's not really something that a textbook narcissist would get involved in, I don't think. What do you think?
I can see it kind of fitting, especially with the whole, like, the 80s, you know, thing of everything where everyone wants what everyone else has and they want their stuff to be better than other people's. So, you know, they're not necessarily happy with the person that they're in a relationship with. They want what everyone else has, or the other person's like, oh, your girlfriend's better than mine, so I'm going to go bang your girlfriend.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when you put it that way. But I mean, his I guess his aloofness of, like when he's discussing this in one of his monologues, he says, "I'm pretty sure, I think her name was Lisa, is nailing my friend Bryce. I don't really care because I'm completely detached from all of this and I'm basically inhuman. But I am also nailing Courtney, who is Matt Ross's fiance. So those two don't really fit in a weird way."
Well, I think it might just be he's not really attached to the other chick that he's nailing on the side. Just more of like he wanted what someone else had. Like, because the whole scene with the business cards where, you know, that guy's is better than mine, even though it's just slightly different. Mm-hmm. So he's like, well, I'm going to, you know, nail this guy's girlfriend because she's a little bit better than mine, even though I really don't care. Don't care about her as a person or anything. It's just the fact of like having that, having the want of whatever what someone else has.
That makes sense. Yeah, and there's like a one-upsmanship to it, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
Also. Yeah, that makes sense. Right on.
I like one scene where he's in the bar, and it's one of those classic ones where it's like, and she's like, "Oh, what do you do?" And she thinks he says that I'm into mergers and acquisitions, but he's like, "I'm into murders and executions."
See, and that's one of the things that kind of leads me down the path of none of this ever happening. Because, I mean, I get it. They're in a loud bar, and there's a lot of music and stuff like that. And she looked like she was a little bit out of it to begin with.
Yeah.
So she may have just heard mergers and acquisitions. But she, like, there's no reaction to murders and executions.
No.
Now, this happens a couple of times throughout the movie. At the point where he's yelling at the Asian lady in the dry cleaners about his sheets. And then he says, "I'm going to fucking kill you." And then she, like, takes a step back. But then, like, instantaneously, they're right back into screaming at each other as if it didn't happen at all.
Yeah, well, there's a scene, too, like, that kind of leads to everything at the end where he's at the ATM. And he sees the cat. And the ATM's like, "Feed me a stray cat."
Yeah.
And he's like, okay. And he starts, like, you know, he'll go to kill the cat. And that lady's like, "Don't kill that cat." So he kills her instead and lets the cat go.
Yeah.
But, like, it's an ATM saying, "Feed me a stray cat." So you're like, no.
No.
ATMs wouldn't say that.
No.
So that kind of clues you in right there. You're like, oh, maybe he is hallucinating stuff.
That's what I'm thinking, man. That's just my opinion, though. I could be completely wrong. Unless that is the same ATM that called Stephen King an asshole at the beginning of Maximum Overdrive. In which case,
that
we should... Yeah, we should probably just get rid of those ATMs altogether. They're rude, and they're making weird suggestions, Mandy. We can't have that.
AI taking over.
Totally. And being real dicky about it, too. Jeez.
Yeah. Well, I imagine robots would be kind of like jerks if they took over.
I agree completely. Right on, young lady. So, have you seen... You said you haven't seen the second one anytime soon?
Not recently. I saw it years ago.
Okay, well, let's just stick to the first one, then. In the first movie, did you have any favorite kills or any favorite scenes or anything?
I think the chainsaw scene's pretty awesome.
Albeit highly improbable.
Yeah, but I think it's just, like, hilarious because just the way he's, like, chasing her and he's just completely naked except for running shoes.
Yeah.
And just... splattered in blood and just like all crazy chasing her with a chainsaw down like the hallway and stuff, and she goes running down the stairs and he just like takes the time to like line it up to like drop this chainsaw on her, and no one else in the apartment building hears a chainsaw down the hallway.
No, and she's banging on doors as she's going. Nobody opens a door for her.
Yeah, but I think that's just like, you know, it's like one of the standout scenes to me because it's just ridiculous. Where, you know, being chased with a chainsaw in general is kind of ridiculous, I think, in any horror movie.
But if it's by a naked, blood-spattered man, that makes it downright horrifying.
Plus, it's the little bit where he has his like white running shoes on, too.
Yeah, yeah, he actually stops to put some shoes on.
Yeah, he's gonna chase after her with the chainsaw.
Yeah, you never know. She might make it out to the street. You know, there might be broken glass or something. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. I kind of like that one. That sort of sticks out in my mind.
Yeah. I think probably Jared Leto getting axed in the head is one thing. For some reason, the scene with Chloe Savini in the apartment really, really sits with me.
Oh, it's just because it's like a longer shot, like it holds on it a bit longer with the nail gun to the back of her head.
There's that, and then there's the, like that whole build-up. When she comes over, and he's going from hot to cold on her like that.
Yeah.
Because he's, like, being very affectionate. Well, I mean, as affectionate as he can be, I guess. But he's talking to her about how nice she looks, and then he offers her the sorbet. But then she accidentally puts the spoon on the table, and he's like, "Get that off the table!" She's like, "Oh, shit!" And then he goes right back into, you know, being Mr. Smooth. until, you know, the nail gun comes out, but then the phone rings. And I feel like that entire scene right there was like our one glimmer of hope for Mr. Bateman.
Yeah, that he could be, like, you know, a decent person and not murder everybody he comes across.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, there may be a human being in there somewhere. But also the conversation that happens after Reese Witherspoon gets off the phone, where, you know, Chloe Savini is like, oh, should I stay? Should I go? You can tell she wants to stay. You can tell into him. And, you know, she's like, oh, he's like, oh, something bad's going to happen if you stay. I don't know if I can trust myself. She's taking this conversation as if to say, we may have sex. You may get hurt emotionally by this entire transaction, and that's not something I want to do. What he's actually saying is, I'm probably going to, you know, shoot you in the head with a nail gun, and yes, you will
get
hurt.
Beat you with a coat hanger.
Yeah, you know, break out my weirdo murder kit and videotape some shit for you.
Yeah.
But the juxtaposition of those two conversations that happen in one conversation, I think that entire scene kind of resonated with me a little bit. I think.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty standout scene in the movie.
Totally. Any breakout performances in this little film here, Mandy? Anybody that you're proud of besides, of course, Kristen Stewart and his ungodly abs?
Well, Chloe Savini, like, she's kind of a pretty good standout in it being, like, you know, the dutiful secretary. You can tell is just completely in love with him and just, you know, obeys, like, anything he says. And even though she's in love with him, she's booking the restaurant for him and his fiance. And, you know, I don't think that, like, even after she found, like, the murder journal, she probably wouldn't have turned it into the police. She probably would have just, you know, taken it and disposed of it or put it back in the drawer and gone about with her life.
Totally.
I don't think she's the type that would have turned him in, so... And that's a, you know, a pretty standout character.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I also really liked Willem Dafoe in this one.
Yeah.
As Detective
But he's
Kimball.
Good in everything.
Isn't he, though? Except in, I don't know if you've seen Antichrist, but you don't want to see his wiener.
No, I haven't seen that. He's really good in Boondock Saints.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's not the best movie to begin with, but I like him in it. I like him in everything, though. I like the way I think he's just a private detective in this one. I don't think he's an actual police officer, but the way he continues to drill down on Bateman and make him just... You can see whenever he comes around, Bateman gets way out of his comfort zone. He starts sweating a lot. He starts, you know, he's trying to keep up this air of confidence, but at the same time, Kimball is, like, catching him in different lies and little... I mean, there's really... Depending on your thoughts on the ending, there's really no wrongdoing here, or at least none that Patrick can be associated with.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
His behavior is showing that he's going to come apart at the seams if Kimball keeps pressing him on this. And the way Kimball goes about it in just such a friendly, jovial way, and, hey, where were you on the night of the 26th? We really got to figure that out if we're going to track down Paul Allen. And just watching Patrick get all tripped up by this. I think it was I think it was like a nice little yin and yang there, the way that we saw Bateman turn, and the way that Kimball brought about the turn by applying pressure.
Yeah, because, like, the whole time he's sort of like Bateman, sort of, like, you know, on his game and has everything, like, planned out and everything sort of, like, you know, just perfect in his life, and then this detective comes in and he doesn't really know what to do about him.
Right, and he can't control him. He can't just intimidate him or, you know, outclass him the way he has everybody else. Or,
yeah, exactly.
You know, put the 80s sleaze on him.
Yeah, good old 80s sleaze.
Yeah, buddy. just put some grease in your hair and call it a day.
The 80s yuppie Wall Street sleaze.
Love it. Hookers, cocaine, weird nightclubs with ambiguous gay dancers, I think. I don't know. I don't know what's going on.
Spenders.
Yeah, buddy.
The banker shirt.
I do miss the returning of videotapes.
Yeah.
that was an easy out for anything.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, you want to hang out? No, I got to return some videotapes.
The whole process takes long.
It's true. It was a whole thing.
Yep.
All right, Miss Mandy. Any closing thoughts on Patrick Bateman, my dear?
I think that he definitely defines American Psycho, like the title.
Mm-hmm.
He is a classic American Psycho, you know, especially in the 80s, where it's all the excess and the narcissism and the greed and corporate America with the psycho part of straight up just murdering hookers with a chainsaw.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And it fits nicely into the 80s. We're in New York, which is like the 80s sleaze capital of the world.
Yeah.
And it's I mean, New York is different these days. It's all sanitized. But back then, it was like the gritty, grimy, you know, you're either up in the high rise or you've got your foot on the neck of somebody beneath you. So yeah. I think it definitely impersonates this. It's very easy to forget that this movie was made in 2000 and not in 1987.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I love it. Great movie. Great character. Open-ended, of course. I tend to think that he didn't do anything. I think he was just fantasizing this. You obviously disagree, which is fine.
But even if he was, like, fantasizing it still, then that is, you know, a psychological problem.
Oh, absolutely.
He's hallucinating murdering people.
Yeah, absolutely. We should probably get that looked at.
Exactly. Maybe so either way, he deserves to be in the psych ward.
Yeah, maybe some Lexapro or some Xanax. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Something.
Get him going on something. All right, Mandy, I think that will about do us for this episode then, yeah?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us here in the psych ward. We're going to, you know, make some tweaks and some iron out some kinks and stuff like that and be modifying the show. Mandy, how do they get a hold of us on social media?
So you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Psych Ward Pod. We'll have, like, the show art and everything up on there and fun, weird, crazy psychological stuff.
Sure.
Good old creepy horror-based stuff on there.
Absolutely. And Mandy is going to post some 80s selfies very soon.
Yes, I'll post some creepy 80s selfies. And if you want to be a guest or have a suggestion, you know, just hit us up with a DM on there and, you know, you can come talk about other crazy horror villains with us.
Absolutely. All right, Mandy. Well, I guess we will see you in a couple of weeks with another episode of the Psych Ward.
Yes.
Did you know that Whitney Houston's debut LP, called simply Whitney Houston, had 4 number one singles on it? Did you know that, Christy?
You actually listen to Whitney Houston? You own a Whitney Houston CD? More than one?
Ooh. It's hard to choose a favorite among so many great tracks. But the greatest love of all is one of the best, most powerful songs ever written about self-preservation and dignity. Its universal message crosses all boundaries and instills one with the hope that it's not too late to better ourselves. Since, Elizabeth, it's impossible in this world we live in to empathize with others. We can always empathize with ourselves. It's an important message. Crucial, really. And it's beautifully stated on the album.